you just got to get it out there, because everybody's first everything sucks.
Yeah.
And then you do it, and you get yourself out there, and you learn a whole bunch of lessons, and then you start your second thing, and you take the first thing down.
And then you suck less.
And you just suck less, and you do this at the second thing. You know what? I'm a fan of that. I like that. Because everyone wants to be perfect right out of the gate. At least I know I do. People that are texting me about the show, they sometimes vastly disagree with our viewpoints. Or they're like, you talked about X and Y, but you didn't even mention Z. Or like, we talked about X and Z, but not Y. And it's clearly all related. We just kind of brushed over it.
I've gotten that too.
And you're just like, I didn't really think about it. Because it's hard. A lot of people think that this conversation is almost completely scripted.
I know. I tell people, like, look, we really don't touch this.
Yeah.
It's just a rolling conversation. Yeah. Talking.
And there will be times where I intentionally will want to talk about something, but then you'll say something else. I'm like, oh, wait, no, that I want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And we'll roll to a whole different area, and I'll completely forget about that other thing. So, just a shout out to anybody that may happen to be listening to this. It's extremely helpful when you mention something that we kind of passed over that you want to hear more about.
Yeah.
Because then we know what to talk about in the future.
I like our random spiels too. Getting talking about Spartans and fighting before millennials and
yeah, it's fascinating. I don't know.
It's that randomness.
Yeah. Know? Sometimes I wonder if having a proper introduction with some techno music and some like, welcome to the greatest show in the universe.
Breakfast at Timothy's.
Yeah, would be cool. It'd be nice. It'd be easier, but eh.
I think that's when people like doubt if we're like scripted or edited. I feel like the random conversation before, because it just feeds into it usually so naturally, it's like, oh, okay, they really are like unscripted. They're just having a conversation, mm-hmm. You know, it kind of makes it feel like, yeah, that's authentic. That's the way it's going.
It's two dudes
mm-hmm.
that have breakfast at Timothy's.
Boom. I love Aardwolf, by the way.
Aardwolf? Ooh.
Mm-hmm. I feel like they've just kind of like started branching out, because I used to never see them in like restaurants, and now it seems like every restaurant has Aardwolf around here.
I went to our local Empire City Gastropub. You can pay me next time.
Yeah.
But I went to Empire City Gastropub, and there was an Aardwolf representative there, and he was just like, hey, you want a mug? Sure, why not? Here we go. Now I'm advertising for them.
You know, you could probably design your life, probably not big things, not like huge, like you probably wouldn't get a couch for free or stuff like that, but you could probably design your life, especially if you're like a newly college grad, or you just finished technical school, wherever you're at when you're in your like young 20s, just kind of starting out, you're poor, you don't have anything,
mm-hmm.
you don't necessarily want to spend all your money on buying stuff. You probably just design your life for that first few years of just going to events and like promos and stuff, and getting like free t-shirts and mugs and glasses and coasters.
Yeah.
And like fill your house with stuff just from events that you wouldn't have to pay for.
Probably. I think maybe furniture would be hard.
Maybe you go to some giveaways, or you know, do the thing where you touch the table and you can't pee, and whoever pees last wins.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But if you really didn't want to do it, that'd be an interesting case study to see how much of your home you could fill in a year by doing that.
Oof. Yeah.
If you lived in a major city, I think you could do well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We should start, just to finish this off, or not finish it off, but just to kick this area off, we should start engraving forks with Breakfast at Timothy's, and that'd be the free thing we give away.
That'd be pretty cool. It actually fits the theme.
Who gives away free forks?
No.
Nobody.
That would be a hard one, yeah.
Yeah. Everybody always gives away the cups or the everything else, but we'll give away the nice solid forks.
I don't know. Only like 20-some episodes. You think?
This is 20.
We're getting the hang of it?
This is 20. Happy 20th episode-versary.
Happy 20th episode anniversary to you, too.
Oh, nice. Nice. All right. So today, well, first off, welcome to another caffeinated episode of Breakfast at Timothy's.
Super caffeinated today.
Yeah. I think I might have made the coffee a little strong.
I usually like never get like the shakes or anything where caffeine like really affects me. I'm a little jittery today.
Mm.
I'm wired.
Yeah, I bumped up the grams in the in the Chemex.
It's going to be a wild one because now that we disagree, we're really going to go at each other's throats.
Oh, yeah. Super, super at each other's throats. So today we are starting off with kind of a side random idea that I had jotted down in a bookmark. And I started reading the book again and it opened and fell out. And oh, wow. This is actually a pretty interesting idea. But nowadays, haptic suits and VR and all of these things are becoming a thing. So in case nobody knows or somebody out there doesn't know what a haptic suit is, it's essentially suits that have hydraulically controlled limbs that you can put on, right? And it's got all sorts of sensors and feedback and all sorts of stuff like that. And it can either aid, think Aliens 2, if anybody saw Aliens 2. It, where she gets in the suit and it's like the gigantic robot thing, only a lot smaller. I think, what movie was that? Elysium with Matt Damon.
Yes,
had, like, yeah, had a haptic suit in it. Or like, they might not have called it a haptic suit, but it was like that robotic suit. Stuff like that. That's kind of what I'm talking about. Where it's not so much something you climb into, like the Halo armor or stuff like that. It's more an exoskeleton that you put on,
yeah,
that enhances your functions. And something that's fascinated me ever since I was a kid watching cartoons was training in increased gravity. And I feel like a haptic suit, if outfitted correctly, would be able to simulate increased gravity through resistance of your limb movement and resistance of your legs and just all around resistance. It could kind of simulate squashing you down, not necessarily squashing you down, but making your movements harder so that then if you were to turn that off or take that haptic suit off, it would feel as if all of your movements were a lot easier. Yeah. So like doing push-ups, it could slowly, because with all of this technology and this suit and all of these feedbacks and stuff, it would be able to tell almost exactly what your maximum is. And so it would be able to say, all right, we're going to do 47.2 pounds of resistance on your four sets of 10 push-ups, because that's exactly as much pounds as you can handle for four sets of 10. And then the next time it's like 49.3 pounds or anyway, and it can just slowly up that resistance. So it's always, you're training at like your absolute maximum.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah. Well, it would be interesting just for like walking around in everyday life. I feel like you could put it on and it would be zero resistance. And then it's like 1.1% increased. So everything is just that little bit harder. And then you could just keep doing that over and over and over through time. And it would get to the point where you're at 10, 20, 30% harder than what just your movement around, like just normal moving around is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could revert it all the way back down to zero and just probably go crazy. You might end up hitting yourself in the face a couple of times because movements that you expected to be very hard are extremely easy. But
that's tricky though, because obviously, like, there's adverse effects when astronauts go into space because, you know, when you lack that gravity, it's your muscles atrophy, your bones atrophy. So you're kind of saying on the other side, using it for training. But
that's actually interesting combining this. What if astronauts wore haptic suits to simulate gravity so they never had that atrophy?
That's true. So that would probably help.
They're in space, and so technically they're floating around, but their limbs and their joints and all that stuff still have the simulated resistance of the, 14.7 PSI of Earth's gravity?
Yeah, because then, but I don't know, that's a tricky question, because obviously there's effects when you go too light on gravity, and like things start to atrophy. But I think too, just like weight training, right? When you weight train, you're not supposed to weight train too much because it's bad for your joints, like your joints wear and tear.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a haptic suit, even if it's like 10 or 20% plus gravity over the norm, I feel like your body's not used to that. So you'd have to be like super careful on how much you dial it up and like how often you do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like even if you're like, oh, I'm just going to walk around at 20% gravity for 4 hours, I feel like that's like an exponential wear on your like knees or your hips that your body is used to.
Yeah, it's kind of like, obesity in general.
That's true.
A lot of times it's like carrying around a backpack filled with however much weight in it. We'll say 50 pounds just for a number to have. It's like carrying around a backpack with 50 pounds in it. that extra weight over time is really going to start to affect your knees and your mm-hmm. your hips and your lower back. And
because obesity is like super correlated with total surgeries, so like total joint replacements, total knees, total hips, even kind of total shoulders, not so much because they're not weight bearing. But yeah, total knees is like, it's a huge thing. Like it's kind of difficult to find a guy unless he's like, you know, a spec ops guy who, you know, did ruck marches for 20 years. It's hard to find a guy in his like 40s and 50s or even 60s who is having a total knee surgery because they're not obese. Usually obesity is the reason, because that extra pressure. So yeah, that would be, you'd have to be really careful on how you scale that haptic suit.
Yeah. And it would be very interesting, because thinking about it, you wouldn't necessarily, I feel like you would have the weight different. You know, the weight would be carried slightly differently, but maybe
more
not.
More uniform throughout the body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't just be, I don't know, it wouldn't just be like you have more weight on top of you. Mm. It's like everything, every part of the movement is harder. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about.
I think it'd be fun for like recreational events, like you were talking about, like basketball or something Like, you know, you jump into the haptic suit for an hour, do your thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like trampling basketball. It's just part of the experience.
Haptic suit basketball. That would be hilarious, doing like a haptic suit dodgeball, only it's with 50% increased gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's just like, trying to run around and throw the dodgeball. Nobody can
moving
throw.
Super slow.
Yeah, the whole court is like the size of a bedroom. And the ball just kind of falls down.
Actually, on the subject, I think it was Jeff Bezos was talking to someone about like space exploration and finding other planets, and his argument is why would you want to do that? Like, we're kind of meant to be in this gravity. Why would you try and escape this gravity just to be on another gravity? You know, it doesn't really make sense like that. Like, if you were going to go into space, you wouldn't go into space to try and populate another planet. You're just getting stuck in another gravity. You'd go into space to like mine asteroids and use those resources to take back to your planet.
Yeah.
Like, what's the purpose of populating another planet just to be in that other gravity that you might not be meant for?
Yeah. Wasn't he the one that said something about how everybody's, oh yeah, let's go populate Mars. Like, no.
Yeah.
Let's just go populate outer space.
Yeah. He's like, why would you populate a more shitty Earth when you have a better Earth right here?
I think in the way far future, because, you know, love science fiction, all that stuff. In the way far future, it'll probably be humanity is mainly based in space. And like spaceports,
yeah,
and all that sort of stuff. And then planets are pretty much glorified mines. It's like resource mines.
Oh, that's so sad.
But
though.
But that are permanently. I mean, because right now the sustainability of crops is, you know, not the greatest.
Well, yeah, but I guess that's kind of what we do right now. To Earth is just mine it and crop it.
Really, that's what we do. We live here. Only we poop where we eat.
Extract resources. Yeah.
So imagine if all we could just permanently rotate crops around a whole planet that was designed just to kind of grow these one particular crops or this one particular resource. But we didn't have to rely so much on one planet that it drained it. It was just kind of like that bank account where you've got $1 million in it and you live off the interest. It's always making more and you're never having to go down below the point where your base is depleting.
So that brings up, that kind of goes into a broader spectrum thing of, I think with the evolution of technology and where we're going and mining asteroids and spaceports and all this other stuff, I think we're trying to like almost get away from being an animal to an extent. So like 10,000 years ago, like we still are an animal by evolution, but we were like, pretty much, you know, not much separated us from monkeys. Like, yeah, we were more sophisticated and stuff, but we lived the same as animals did. We lived off the land. We had to hunt. We had to gather. We used little tools. You know, we were essentially a glorified animal. And I feel like technology and all this stuff of like haptic suits and bionic limbs, which we can talk about next, bionic limbs, is kind of getting away from being an animal. We're trying to like get to be something else, something that's not vulnerable, something that's not affected by all this stuff. Which is that's a tricky point, because like that's part of being human, you know. Being human is living off the land, is just like when people don't see sunlight, you know, it kind of messes them up. Mm-hmm. Or when they don't, you know, go into nature, they're more likely to be depressed. So if you create this spaceport and you get away from being human, does that have adverse effects that we, you know, are kind of biologically ingrained to have? Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think that the recycled air and all that stuff would probably get to us faster than we might think.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where things like, I mean, if you're going to have sustainable oxygen in terms of like an indefinite amount of sustainable oxygen, you either have to have like an oxygen bank or some sort of scrubber or some sort of
plants everywhere.
Or an atrium, I think is a pretty common thing, like just an atrium filled with plants. And I think that extended space travel, you would almost require people to essentially take tours through this like garden that you have in space,
mm-hmm,
periodically to root us to Earth and all of that stuff. I've noticed very successful people seem to have a lot of plants in their house. I had a lot of plants in my house growing up. I'm growing the collection. I have one. started the collection with one plant. But, you know, everybody's got to start somewhere. Anyway, I think that, yeah, we would... You're 100% right, because even just being on a ship or being in an office building or anything like that where you're breathing recycled air, or just all you can see around you is steel or building or development, if you're in that environment for too long and then you step out of it and you go into the woods and you just take a deep breath, everything relaxes.
So do you think that's our next step? Do you think we're supposed to, which I guess there's no supposed to, you don't know what's right or wrong, but do you think that's the next evolutionary step to get away from being an animal, to evolve in a sense that we don't need to live on a plant-like structure? Mm-hmm. Do you think that's kind of like we should be going in that step? Do you think that's the goal?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my ultimate thing. I think evolution being what it is, you can biologically evolve only so fast, right? Mm-hmm. Before technology or genetic modification comes into play. And I think we, at least at this point, don't know enough about DNA to start messing with DNA of children in the womb, kind of like we can mess with crops, right? Because it's different, the rights and humanity and all that stuff. Like, how do you... Because you can mess with the DNA of a plant. Nobody really cares about that. Well, they do. But it's like, oh, it's a plant. If you make a plant that grows upside inside out on accident, like, oh, okay, whatever. But if you make a person that grows inside out on accident, your project's going to get shut down. And so I feel like the easier thing for us to evolve more quickly is the technological adaptations that we can have. So, like, the fake eyes, the fake limbs, the robotic limbs, the robotic eyes, the haptic suits.
Like, post-birth.
Post-birth augmentation of humans. But we would still have to go through the natural birth, at least for right now. I'm sure in the future, test tube babies could be a thing. But at least as of right now, we aren't exactly capable of messing with DNA, because we understand it, right? We've mapped it and we can figure it out, but nobody's tried to tweak it yet.
Well, there's a few people where, like, obviously now you can choose your sex, the sex of the baby. If you want a boy or a girl, they can play with the DNA and the genes, especially if you're doing what has to be in vitro or like test tube style.
Have they successfully done that?
You can do that, and it costs an exorbitant amount of money, but you can even get to the point now where you can pick eye color. And so it's like you're getting closer and closer to the designer babies, right? Where everyone's gonna want the perfect, perfectly built, blue-eyed, whatever baby. Which that's, you know, I don't know. That's a scary.
The thing with that is, I don't think we understand enough about what traits cause success to really have a good result with that. People are like, all right, I want my kid to be the greatest at math ever. Like, this one gene right here, if we do this, he's just going to understand numbers and all this stuff, but
that's
also
true.
Be
that's super intricate.
He'll also be super creative and all these other things. And you create a kid and he's super creative and super great at math and he's autistic. It's like,
that's true.
We don't know what, well, he's not necessarily autistic, but he's just so into that.
Well, you mess with one thing, you don't know the domino effect of another.
Exactly. I think there was a movie or a book. I think it was called A Rose for Algernon. We'll have to look it up.
Yes, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, they made you read that in high school.
Yeah, well, it was one of the books in high school. So yeah. A lot of people have read it. And if anybody out there hasn't read it, it starts off, this guy's, he's mentally handicapped, right? And they come up with this drug that makes somebody smarter and smarter the more they take it. And it's kind of this guy, I believe his name was Algernon, it's his journey from being mentally handicapped, and then he starts taking the drug and he starts getting smarter and smarter and smarter, and he gets
smartest person on the earth.
Well, he gets more and more popular, right? Mm-hmm. And he starts to be socially accepted, and then he gets pretty successful, and then he keeps going and keeps getting smarter and smarter and smarter, and then he starts getting less accepted and less socially popular. And then he ends spoiler, but I think you see where this is going. He ends the story in the same place that he began it, as a social outcast, and nobody understands him.
I thought, wasn't it, he got to the point too where his mind was starting to degrade, mm-hmm. and like he was going to die because his mind was degrading?
I think so. It's been probably over a decade since I read it. I just remembered the social aspect, how he started the spectrum socially, I guess, not accepted, and then ended. He was so smart that once again, people didn't understand him.
Yeah.
And he was once again, socially not accepted.
I think he like ended up winning a Nobel Peace Prize because he did some like crazy thing in mathematics. Cause he literally had like super genes, but yeah, he was essentially like a lab rat in the end where like it was experimented on and he ended up dying. That brings up a tricky point.
Yeah.
And if you start messing with designer babies, then genetic variation goes down. When you have genetic variation goes down, you know, you're more...
There's just going to be that one disease.
Yep, that wipes out everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be weird, too, because then when you lessen the genetic variation, if you have two designer kids having babies with each other, then it's like basically brother and sister, or it could be because your genes are so similar, or there's just not enough spread, so... You know, then you have those issues come up. Then you have Cyclops babies.
And this is what I'm saying. Like, it's the easiest or the least downside is evolving technology. Because we can test technology independent of people. And then there are, unfortunately enough, there are enough people out there with either amputated limbs or some sort of handicap in a limb, where they would be willing to undergo a surgery to try out these new bionic limbs, which we're getting very advanced.
Oh,
in the bionic limb area. Oh, man. It's crazy where we're at.
That kid who opened up the open source, I think it's called like the Open Hand Project or something like that.
With the Legos? Is that the one that's by Lego?
No, he was the kid who first created the first like 3D printed bionic arm, where it's like straight up fingers and everything, like every nerve, every like tendon that a hand and a forearm would have, this kid like created 3D printed. But he made all the blueprints open source. So the idea was, right now, like, amputated limbs cost like ridiculous, like $50,000 or something. He's like, you can 3D print this for $200. Someone scale this, mass produce it, and make it so these soldiers are diabetics or anyone who has to have an amputation can have a normal limb. But
and one thing that we were talking about before we got started that I think is now's a good time to bring it up is, when is it going to get to the point where, all right, so you don't have a limb, it's got amputated, and so you therefore get a replacement and it works okay, but with technology, obviously everything over time gets better and better and better, Moore's law, right? So what happens when the fake and artificial limbs work better than your normal, naturally birthed arm? Like, it's stronger, it's faster. You could have whatever attachments. You can't even imagine what they would be. I think you said Wi-Fi.
Yeah. So let me ask you. So if they had the bionic limb, you got Wi-Fi in it, you got all these cool ass gadgets you can do. I don't know, you got a laser, whatever. Anything you want in this bionic limb, would you amputate your arm to get the new bionic limb?
The real question for me is, I wouldn't want to be the first one to do it, right? But if it was a proven technology, right, 100% or close to 100, like 90, we'll say 95% plus success rate, and there weren't any long-term side effects like achy joints or achy, where the two things meet up, aches, because I've heard that happens when they attach it. It's kind of, it works, but at the same time, it doesn't.
The ghost pains.
Yeah, you got ghost pains and all those sorts of things, and where the two meet up, just aches pretty much constantly. Mm. If we could get away from that and go past it, for example, I think a lot of different movies have had cell phones built into the hand.
Oh yeah.
Or eyes that you take out and then are plugged right in with crazy optics and optic scanners and stuff like that. Anyway, I think things like that would be very, very interesting. And I wouldn't be 100% against it at all.
But here's the thing. So if someone's plugging those eyes into you or like changing your hand, they have the DNA, they have your like sequencing code to be able to put that in. So then someone could theoretically hack your hand or hack your eyes and be controlling your, you know, sight or hand movements or anything.
Absolutely. We're already there with biological weapons, which we talked about a couple episodes ago.
Yeah.
We're actually, has it been out? I don't know if it's been released yet.
Not out yet.
Well, I guess at this point it will have been released.
Yeah.
But yeah, we talked about that in a previous episode about how biological weapons are to the point where you can specifically attack one DNA, and that's essentially hacking your person. Yes, it takes a little bit more, and you're right. If it's electronic, then hypothetically there's a way to hack into it, and it could be bad, especially if somebody figured out a way to hack into mass amounts of them and create kind of slave limbs or slave people. For if everybody had a haptic suit and you figured out the main program for the haptic suit, they're like, oh, okay, pink. Now everybody has to do what I tell them to do.
Yeah. See, that's where, and this is going to be a very unsophisticated argument, and I think it's hard to make a sophisticated one because we just don't know the effects, we don't know the whys yet. We're still like figuring out our own existence, but I don't know. It's kind of like mortality, right? When people want to live forever, or they want to design the genes so that the body never ages, you kind of go through this lifestyle. And don't get me wrong, there are some people who are in denial about death and they still don't accept it even when they're on like death's doorstep. But a lot of people, especially when you get older and older and you get like the centurions who live into their hundreds, you know, you talk to most of them and you read the interviews and they're ready to go. Like, they're like, you know, I've had my time. I've experienced enough. I'm kind of ready for the next phase. I'm tired. I'm tired of being in this body. I'm tired of, you know, being in this mind. So it's kind of this natural progression. And do you want to start messing with mortality? You know, and I don't have there's no scientific argument around it because there's no why or specific reasoning. But for me, I just feel like, you know, the roots are the roots for a reason. Like human nature is the way it is. I just don't know if you want to start messing with it.
Well, so a reoccurring theme in places with where humans become immortal, right? Specifically humans become immortal a lot, or not immortal, but extended lifespans. And it's a reoccurring theme in a lot of fictional works. But one of the other reoccurring themes is that people past like 200, 300 years, they've done everything. They've seen mostly everything. Obviously, history and its recurrent patterns, they can just see things and trends happen over and over again. And it just gets old.
Yeah.
I mean, I've read all the books that I was interested in. I could read other books, but I'm not really interested in reading those books.
Yeah, you're kind of bored of reading.
Yeah, the movies start to repeat themselves. The songs start to repeat themselves.
Yeah.
The fashion trends come and go and back and come and go. And I'm sure you'd see a couple world wars in that time. And it just starts to get kind of old, it seems like.
Because I guess the ideal life is you'd have... Life is boring without relationships, right? so you want to have really close relationships with friends and family and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what makes like a very meaningful life is your relationships. So best case scenario, you know, what's the ideal life that you live 1,000 years instead of 100? So you have these really close relationships, you go on vacations, you work on something to progress, you know, whatever your passion is. But like you said, like, even if you had these close relationships and you lived in a little tribe of your friends and family, I feel like after 1,000 years, you'd get kind of tired of those people. Like, even after 1,000 years of doing work on any subject, you'd be like, all right, I'm kind of done doing this. I'm bored.
Yeah.
Like you said, I've experienced it.
Well, on that, it's almost like a scale thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a couple of other fictional works, I think humanity at one point was, and this is obviously fictional, but humanity was one of the immortal races. And I think this was Lord of the Rings. I'm not positive though. But then the gift to humanity was its mortality. Because they found, right, that everything, every being that could live for 1,000 years, 300 years, 10,000 years, however long, essentially indefinitely, or on a lot slower scale, they didn't have the drive to advance their civilization, advance their race, because, or at least not on the same scale. They were okay with the status quo because they had time. They had a ton of time.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like our gift to us is the fact that we are going to die. And not only are we going to die, but we know we're going to die.
Yeah.
And so that puts like a countdown timer almost on everything that we want to do in life. It's like, all right, hey, listen, you have X amount of time, really probably a good, because we'll say up until the age of, I don't know, for the average person, we'll say 25 or so, you're learning,
yeah, right?
You're figuring everything out. Some people figure some stuff out a little earlier, sometimes later, but up until about 25, you're essentially learning and becoming how to be a human.
Yeah.
And then past like 75, you're essentially, I don't know, you've probably done most of your life's work. And there are people that have been productive past 75, and still there are still people that do it. But in terms of your life's work, I'd say it's probably done between 25 and 75. And so that's like a 50-year countdown timer that you have to get whatever it is that you want to get done, done.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to if you were, I don't know, if you lived 1,000 years, that would give you 500 years to get what you wanted to get done, done.
Yeah, that's true. Like, you're only expanding the middle portion.
Yeah.
Like, your beginning and your end is kind of the same timeline for mm-hmm. the most part. So then you'd be doing your life's work for, like, instead of, you know, if you live to 150 years, like you said,
mm-hmm.
exponent that, and you have 25 years on each side. And it's like, there's these natural progressions in life, right? And some people try and fight them. Some people see the beauty of them. And it's kind of like seasons, where mm-hmm. you have this growing and this expanding, and then you go through school, and then you go through work, and you do these projects, and you're building, and then you have this nice little progression at the end of life where you get to relax a little bit, and you get to, you know, travel a little bit more and live that kind of life. But when you take out those progressions and then you just expand this middle portion, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It seems kind of, like you said, it just seems kind of dull. Like, you'd be doing the same thing, essentially. You'd just be living that middle part over and over again, or for a super extended period.
Yeah, but if you and everybody you knew lived that long, would time dilate to fill that? Would 1,000 years feel the same to you relatively as 100 years feels to your average human now?
Oh man, I don't know. It's kind of like marriages. Would you be married to someone for 500 years then?
Yeah.
Do you think that?
And that's the thing. Like, is it, because to us, that's like crazy. You want to be married to somebody for five full lifetimes. But if you lived 1,000 years, maybe that's normal.
Maybe
that's perfectly normal.
I feel like human nature, though, you'd still have the same disagreements. I feel like the divorce rate would just be like astronomical. To have two people agreeing on things, living similar, you know, compatible lives for that long.
I would be willing to debate that it would be roughly the same.
Yeah.
I think.
You think it would scale?
I think it would scale. I think if you can be with somebody and it's pretty much just you and them for, I don't know, we'll say 10 years, and you can get along for 10 years, you've passed all of the endorphins and all of the chemicals that have been released in your brain. Mm-hmm. You've passed the initial good friends place. You've even passed, at that point, you've all aged past your prime, right? Mm. You're no longer your prime attractiveness, or I mean, it depends on what you're into, but you're no longer your youthful self. If you are still together and you're still getting along after 10 years, I think you can go for a while.
Oh, man, I don't know, though, because a lot of people get divorced on kind of like that 15 to 20 year mark.
Yeah.
You know, when the kids are like 5 to 10 years old. Like, I knew so many friends that their parents got divorced like as they were growing up. Like, I've heard of very few divorces that happen before the kids are like aged, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, usually it seems like it happens kind of like that midlife crisis type time.
Mm.
Kind of 15 to 20 years in, or...
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. You make a good point.
Well, that's what I mean. The same rate, it would be the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
It just scales.
The
same people get along, the same number of people that can make it last their whole life are the same number of people that can't.
It brings up, so a good point with kids. Would you be cranking out kids for like 500 years and like still be having kids every 20 years? Why not?
Well you got to think, kids... they would grow up and it would take, I don't know, 200 years before your kid would be an adult. And so that's all.
Oh, so you're saying like even the scale time.
I'm saying everything scales.
Oh, so it'd be like so holy shit, you'd be pregnant for like
a long
80
time.
Months.
Yeah. Because you're
that would be brutal.
Debatably, aging is your metabolic rate, right?
Uh-huh.
And so your metabolic rate would have to be extremely slow.
True.
And so how long it would take for a creature to come about would scale.
Be having that reverse Benjamin Button, yeah.
You'd be pregnant for 9 years.
Good God. That poor women.
Labor would take probably a year in of itself.
I think women are out of that scenario. They don't want anything to do with that now.
Yeah.
You know, 100 years sounds pretty good. We're good the way we are.
Yeah, but then you got to think. Anyway, yeah, so.
But see, this whole discussion, it's hard. Where do you create the cutoff point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of talking about disabilities before. It'd be amazing that you have this, you can alter the genes so that, you know, or you have the technology, kind of like the limb technology, where you can fuse together spinal cords successfully. So you get rid of people being paralyzed. And so you can get rid of all these terrible diseases or blindness or paralyzation, but where do you stop it? You know, where do you say, all right, we can mutate these genes, we can successfully like engineer this stuff, but we're going to draw the line here.
Mm-hmm.
Once that technology is out there, it's really hard to draw that line and say like, all right, we're going to do these good things, but we're going to somehow keep it there, keep it from expanding.
Oh man. So with that, I was watching a documentary, as I do frequently, but it was about it, or a segment of it covered this girl. She was maybe 11 or 12 years old, right? And her parents thought she had something very wrong with her, and would sporadically shout and yell and couldn't ever formulate a whole sentence and was just kind of making noises and stuff and would randomly twitch her body. It was very sad to watch. But then one day she sat down at a computer. Her mom was typing or something like that. And the daughter was throwing this fit and wanted to use the computer. We're like, all right. So the mom let her use her computer. And over 45 minutes, one key at a time, this little girl typed out an entire paragraph. And not just like a paragraph of gibberish, but an intelligible sentence of a paragraph. And it was then, and they played it all together. They read it all together. And essentially, the little girl was trapped inside her own head. And over the period of like the next several months, they found out that she has normal thoughts. She can process everything normally. And she's trying to tell her body to do things. And it's just not listening to her.
Yeah.
And she like tries to say words. She tries to say sentences. She tries to walk normally and doesn't want to do all these outbursts and things like that. And is fighting it all the time, essentially, and she can't. And it's just, she's trapped in her own head. And so people talking to her like she doesn't understand them makes her angry. Even though from the outside, it seems like she doesn't understand what you're saying and she can't interact with you. It makes her upset because she's like, I totally can understand everything that everybody's saying. at a normal rate, I just can't say anything back.
Yeah.
Granted, this took months and months of typing one key every 30 seconds to a minute, but they got it all out of her. And it's just like, holy crap.
Like Richard Dawkins style.
Yeah. I just wish for those types of people that have something wrong with them that they would be able to be given a body that listens to them. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah.
And sometimes you see people in wheelchairs and everybody's different, right? But if we get to the point where we can technologically have people either not necessarily prevent it, but if something happens in somebody's life that they then are then paralyzed from the neck down, or they have some sort of debilitating disease that happens, then they could be given a body that listens to them, mm-hmm. or at least some sort of augmentation that makes it easier.
But see that, and I agree too, that would be a beautiful thing. It's just the, like, how do you stop it, right? So every mm-hmm. technological advancement that you have, that gets you X further in whatever field, for as many benefits as it presents, there are usually just as many negatives.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you create this technology that can fuse the spinal cord or create this limb or whatever, but then you have the problems of, you know, controlling that person, or adverse effects where someone can get a hold of the technology and build an army of whatever they want, or
mm-hmm.
so that's why it's like this dangerous thing where it's like, ooh, how do you keep this proprietary information for the good of the people only? It's kind of like, you know, it's like AI.
Mm-hmm.
AI, right? AI can do amazing things, but then you have a lot of scientists, a lot of very intelligent people that are like, look, Terminator is like a realistic example. Like this shit could come back around
mm-hmm.
and undo us all.
Yeah.
So it's tricky.
So that's almost more of like a moral dilemma. And this sounds maybe cold-hearted, maybe not, I don't know. But I think the only way to really get into it and just actually find out what people are going to do, and you almost have to take the benefit of the doubt, but it would be to just develop the technology and not necessarily take into account the downsides and the potential downsides.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to look, like, weigh the benefit over the possible downsides. Like, because if you're looking at improving somebody's life 100-fold versus the possibility that one person later might take advantage of it and hack into the system, it's like, all right, yeah, that might happen, but that's almost inevitable. And if we never develop the technology, then we'll never improve lives, but also this slight negative thing would never happen either. And so it's like, it's like this positive negative, like, do we just stop developing all technology or like new medicines or new information that could always be taken advantage of, or do we just move forward anyway?
See, that's where I think we're like a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it's hard too, because I see that side and it makes sense, and I can't really describe why I feel the way I do, but
why don't you give it a shot?
All right. Well, it's kind of that slippery slope, right? Where you're creating benefits, and then soon you get to the point where there's infinite longevity. You know, there's no suffering. You're living in a complete utopia. Those emotions like don't even exist. And then essentially it comes back to what we were talking about before. You're no longer human. You're getting away from the aspect of being a human. And I think that's what makes us so unique. And fortunately, I have the reasoning behind this. Maybe I'm affected by this because I'm a healthy young male and I don't have any serious defects and I'm not going through any of those terrible things, and I'm sure my attitude would probably be different if I was.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's kind of, it's part of being human. And even as terrible as those things are, it's just, again, it's that slippery slope where you cure one thing and I don't think it stops. I think you get to that point where you keep advancing until there's no mortality, there's no suffering, and you're no longer like a human animal.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, then life becomes a monotony, right? Like monotony of everyday life of, yeah, it sounds great to live in this utopia where you're never sad and you never have to feel pain and all those receptors are turned off, but it's really not that great as it sounds. You get sick of that too. And then you're taking away these pivotal moments that might create you as a person, right? Like Richard Dawkins. It's Richard Dawkins didn't have, I think it's ALS that he has.
I'm not 100%, but I believe that's right. Yeah.
I mean, who knows? Maybe he wouldn't be as motivated. Maybe he wouldn't have created the works that he did and done those kind of things. So, you know, you might be taking away art because so many artists, they create this beautiful art out of pain and out of sorrow and terrible events. So you're taking all of these amazing, intricate things that happen out of hardship.
Mm-hmm.
And you're essentially, like, we've kind of talked about hardship before. When you eliminate hardship, what happens
mm-hmm.
to a society? And with those advancements, you're essentially, you could take away all of hardship. Everyone would be perfect. Everyone would always be healthy. Never be anything wrong. No pain. And that's where it's like, I don't know what happens to human society at that point. I don't know if it would truly better us
mm-hmm.
than if we kept those hardships and that pain and sorrow and all that.
It reminds me of a quote. And it went, hard times make strong people. Strong people make good times. Good times make weak people. Weak people make hard times.
Mm.
And it's just this kind of cycle. With that, I think comes into play. So when you've taken the basics of humanity, right? Just the basic survival, everything. And then that is now guaranteed, right?
Yeah.
So you no longer have, let's say, like physical problems with you or with your environment, everything is solved, then you move up that next tier. And somebody was talking about first world problems, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, first world problems, blah, blah, blah. So that would, it would then elevate humanity to where it's now like our base problems are kind of gone, but there would still be problems and there would still be hardships. And mm-hmm. it would be relative and different. And so we would still have things that are wrong in our life. A lot of them might be made up in somebody's own head or relative.
Yeah.
But I think they would still exist. And maybe that's just me. But
does that make us better as a society, I guess?
Because
a lot of, you look at even first world problems right now, right? So we've gotten mm-hmm. to this point where if you live in America and you're from like a lower middle class and up, as long as you're not on the extreme side of poverty, and even then, you probably still have an iPhone and a bunch of other stuff too. Then your problems change, like you just said. So you have these problems, the first world problems of, oh my gosh, I don't have, I don't know, peanut butter in the house. And now I have to drive 5 minutes to go get peanut butter
mm-hmm.
or whatever. You're creating these menial problems that are really kind of stupid. And a lot of people, I think, are realizing that the first world lifestyle is not a guarantee of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
That working corporate life for 40 years and building this retirement account so that I retire doesn't guarantee happiness. And a lot of people are still searching for more. And that's why people are going back to like the roots of humanity, which is kind of where the third world lives, but with comfort, right? So mm-hmm. farming and growing your own food or getting back to nature or writing more, reading more, kind of like the simplicities of life that really make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, if we got to that point where, yeah, now the first world problems are like the new third world problems, I feel like people would still want to go back and they'd still be searching for that thing
mm-hmm.
that's not satisfying them.
Yeah, maybe. I hate to bring up Mr. Robot again, but not really. There was a line in there where the woman, one of the main women leads, was just like, I know you want to give me vacations to exotic places and fancy things and fancy cars and all of these things, but I don't want that. I had that before. I had all of the things I could ever want, all of the travel, all of the houses, all of the cars I could ever want, and none of it made me happy. What you give me is, she was talking to this guy who was kind of lesser well off than she was, like, you give me something that's completely different from that and makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like none of those monetary things made her happy, but I guess just being with this other person and the experiences that they had were making her happy.
So we have this like almost biological sense that we don't like easy, not too easy anyways. There's mm-hmm. a line: when things get too easy, you get bored or you get dissatisfied. And that contentment just doesn't last.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we crave a little challenge by nature,
mm-hmm.
those kind of things. And when you create this life that's so easy, that's so planned out, that you don't have to worry about anything, no hardships, people start searching for something because that can't possibly fulfill you.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, but that's an interesting argument because, like you said, I mean, I see both sides. I see that, you know, if I was blind, I probably want to see. I probably want that genetic enhancement so I could see again.
Yeah. Well, that's on that, on the blindness and the... So with deafness, there are cochlear implants that are essentially eliminating deafness, right? Mm. People no longer have to be deaf. At first, it was kind of a interesting experimental technology, but now it's pretty proven and they can do it over and over and over again to make it so that deaf people can hear, which is creating an interesting thing that I think nobody saw coming, where people who are born deaf or become deaf get a pride in the fact that they are deaf and they identify as it. And even though they could hypothetically get a surgery to fix it and then they would no longer be deaf, they're so proud that they want to remain deaf. Mm. It's part of their identity. Like, no, I don't want to be able to hear. I'm deaf. I've been deaf. That's the way I live. And there's this like weird community of people that are upset at other deaf people that are getting these cochlear implants and not being deaf anymore. It's like, and I don't understand it, but I'm obviously not deaf. And so it's this fascinating human psychology thing where even though, yes, they are deaf and they could fix it, they're choosing not to.
True. So it's kind of, this is not the same analogy, but it is an analogy nonetheless. Of kind of like plastic surgery. You're not liking something that you're born with, so you're changing it.
Mm.
And it's kind of like people who are born...
It's similar.
Yeah, born the way they are and say the way they are. They're like, all right, well, you know, why can't you just deal with the way you're born? Why do you need double D boobs if you have B boobs? Why don't you just be happy with your B boobs?
Mm-hmm.
Or forehead wrinkles or whatever it is. But yeah, so same kind of concept where... I mean, it's easy to say like, oh, come on, it's a disability. Why would you not want that fixed? But, you know, we look at people who are doing plastic surgery and we're like, why would you do that? Come on, just like be happy with the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really kind of relatable.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
With plastic surgery, and I think that goes along with what you were talking about earlier, people being different. If everybody starts to look the same, then those oddballs, I think part of the what makes supermodels supermodels is the fact that they are genetically so unique. They're just like, they are weird, right?
Yeah.
They have extra long legs and like tiny torsos. And if you put them next to a normal person, not on a stage, not wearing makeup, you're probably not going to think they're very attractive.
Well, no, keep going. Sorry.
No, that's it. And it's just this weird thing where you're just like, wait, what? Like that's a supermodel? She looks like a lanky spider. That doesn't look right at all. But then you slap a bunch of makeup on her, put her in some lingerie in the Victoria's Secret fashion show, all of a sudden she looks great. And so you're like, oh, wow, wait, no, actually, yeah, that person's very attractive. But then you realize that they've got these like very accentuated cheekbones, almost like an alien-esque type face, just super, everything's very defined. I think that if everybody were to look like that, then that's no longer what would be so unique and attractive. And probably what makes them so appealing is that it's so different than what the average person is. And so if the average person then looks like that, then we're going to look for the next thing that's so unique and individual.
True.
So.
Odd fact. There's some genetic, I don't want to say it's a disorder, but there's some genetic commonality between supermodels. And it's something... We are definitely going to have to show notes this, so do not take my word verbatim. We learned about it in like AP Psych, like
the podcaster
years ago.
Clearly stated.
I'm gonna have to research this, but I know I remember from one of those classes that it's a genetic anomaly that it's like you're almost intersex, right? A lot of these supermodels, like they're not born with ovaries and all these things, and that's why they're super tall and they have like kind of some of them have like. Not feminine, what's the opposite of masculine traits, like the, you know, super defined jawline, that's kind of a masculine type trait. But there's this weird, it's intersex kind of genetic difference that happens that makes supermodels so similar. Mm-hmm. And there's some crazy statistic, like 70-80% of supermodels have these genetic markers that change the way they are, mm-hmm. so that they do look like that. So yeah. It literally is like a genetic difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm definitely going to have to show note that and say what it's called.
Mm-hmm. Because once again, I'll just repeat what I said earlier. If you stand a super, like see a supermodel standing next to a normal person, you're like, they don't look nearly as attractive as they do on a stage surrounded by other supermodels.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I don't know.
Kind of like, well, going back to the genetic variance type of thing too, right? People are attracted to different things,
mm-hmm.
and like for good reason. So if you made everyone the same, then you're taking away, maybe someone likes, I don't know, someone with thick eyebrows. Maybe they're just, you know, they're into that, or they're into someone with a different shaped nose or this or that. And you can't explain what you're attracted to,
mm-hmm.
but people are attracted to a wide variety of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you make everyone the same, you're taking away that uniqueness. Just like, I don't know. Every, you know, we pride ourselves on, like, you're told when you're growing up every day in school, like, everyone's different for a reason. That's how, like, that's why society's beautiful, and, you know, everyone's so unique, and that's why everyone's beautiful, and you should get to know different people because of that. But then you, like, grow older, and it seems like everyone's trying to, like, pursue this perfection, this kind of, like, same thing.
Yeah.
Get away from that. They don't want to be different anymore, you know? They just want to look perfect or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah, everybody growing up always, and kind of still to this day, gives me flack about my eyebrows, right? Because they used to be very thick.
I totally did not mean that comment directed towards
well,
you.
But it's fine. They used to be like very thick, and I've, you know, tamed them down like mm-hmm. a lion tamer with some help. But it's such a unique thing about my face, right? It's a very distinct facial feature, and not a ton of people have extremely thick eyebrows, right? And mm-hmm. it's actually been a defining characteristic that people thought was attractive or or drew them to me, or was just like essentially, if you were going to draw one of those cartoon what are those called, characterizations,
yeah.
We're going to draw a characterization of myself, it'd probably have some pretty thick eyebrows, but not everybody has those. And so it's like, whoa, weird, what's this? And then it's kind of, it draws people in,
mm-hmm.
Or at least makes me a little bit more unique than the next person. So here's a whole different thing, right? When I was a kid, I used to think I was going to grow up and I was going to have all these tattoos. My role model was Travis Barker for the longest time, because I thought the look was great. He's a fantastic drummer for Blink-182, had all these tattoos. I was like, man, this guy is the man. I want to be exactly like him. And I go off, right? And I keep debating on what tattoo I want to get, and I never really come around to one. And then I go back home after a few years, and every single one of my friends has at least one tattoo or multiple tattoos. And then I realized that not having tattoos actually made me more unique than if I had had tattoos. And yes, having a tattoo, like, oh yes, I have this one unique tattoo and that makes me unique. But if I tell somebody I don't have any tattoos, they look at me like I'm crazy.
That's true.
Like, what?
For a millennial, yeah.
Yeah, you're like, you don't have any tattoos? Like, no, I don't have a single one. And it just blows people's minds.
Maybe you're just a hipster.
And
maybe you just don't want to, yeah. You know, you don't like it because everyone else likes it.
Maybe, I don't know. But I thought I was going to be covered head to toe in tattoos. And then I've just never really been able to lock down exactly what I wanted to get permanently tattooed on my body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never got one.
Yep. That's a good story.
Yeah.
It's kind of like working out too. Different phase, but people see a celebrity or a trainer or whatever, and they're like, oh, I want that body, right? I want their body to look exactly like them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of like grow older and you might work out or whatever, and you realize that, A, that's just not possible. It's not your genetics.
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of grow older and you realize, I want the best of my body. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to make this shell that I have as best as possible. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the right route to go down. But it's realizing not that you have to be similar, but you can still improve yourself naturally,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense, with what you're given.
Yeah. Well, it always cracks me up when, for example, like the super skinny guy wants to look like the guy who used to be overweight, but then got really into bodybuilding and is just jacked and enormous.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, all right, hold on. You're probably never going to look like that unless you just eat food and just butter sticks for the next 10 years. Then you could probably put on that much weight. or the chicks that are like super skinny that want to do the same thing, like look like the chicks with like the really big butts and the really tiny waist.
Yeah.
Or the other way around, the girls that are born a little bit thicker that want to look like the really, really skinny chicks. They're like, all right, hold on. This is probably, you're probably not going to have that happen. You're not really able, because what are the three types? You got like ectomorph, endomorph, and then something else.
Yeah. Mesomorph.
Like the three different types of bodies.
Yeah.
And it pretty much, you got to look at like what your body type is. And then based on that, then you can be the ideal version of that.
But even like us, you know, you have different collarbones, you have different like joint sizes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you say you put on 40 pounds to try and be a bodybuilder, you're not going to look like that guy. Your bone structure is still different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe your traps build better than your lats or vice versa or whatever. But I'm stumbling here because it's hard to like get the thought out, but I'm trying to relate it back to the deafness, right? So you're given this attribute. So like with the body, you're given a skinny body. And then you realize over time you're just naturally skinny, but let's try and build this shell as best as I can in the way I want. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's kind of the same thing with deafness, where I'm given this characteristic by birth. This is what it is. I'm deaf, but let's try and become like the best deaf person I could be. Maybe I can, you know, like the guys who click and they can hear, like, they know everything around them based off the click, based off the echo.
Mm-hmm. Sound. The blind people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh yeah, sorry, the blind people, not the deaf. But then, you know, it gives them like this other enhancement where like they're given the traits they are and they're enhancing them in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what gives them that huge pride that it's like making, you know, it kind of relates, making the best of what you have versus muscle building versus being deaf or blind.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Well, and with that stuff, there have been several experiments where people simulated being blind. I think that's the easiest thing to do. They simulated being blind for months at a time and they just kind of wore a blindfold blindfold or these specific glasses that blocked everything out, and they had to learn Braille and all that stuff. And then they got to the point where they were fully functional as a blind person. And then they had memorized the entire Braille alphabet. They could read Braille fluently, get around just fine being blind. And then they took the blindfolds off and then they waited, I think it was like a week or 2 weeks, and retested them on Braille. And they forgot, I want to say it's like 60 or 70% of Braille.
Whoa.
It was crazy how fast they just lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's now a whole thing that they once were able to completely identify as, even though it was just a fake study, they were able to do that and then rapidly lost all of it. Mm. And so this thing that you might be proud of knowing or learning, and you just completely forget.
Yeah. It's kind of like maybe blind people have, or even deaf people have this, like, they develop an amazing imagination, right? Mm-hmm. An imagination of what the sounds are. And they love that imagination more than what it would be if they actually had their sight or their hearing.
Mm.
And they, you know, that's kind of what they identify with and they enjoy. It's kind of like the savant thing, right? Most savants are autistic to some degree. And so a savant is someone who's really, really good at one thing. Like there's a guy who can draw like cities out of memory.
Mm-hmm.
I remember watching a 60 Minutes thing. So he can fly in the helicopter around a city, and then in like 3 hours, he can basically draw every single detail to perfection of that city from memory.
Including like the number of windows in the skyscrapers.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Or like someone who can, you know, play piano like Mozart or even better. But most of those people are on the autistic scale. So it's like, would you give up being autistic, but you'd no longer have that talent?
Mm-hmm.
Again, you're giving up part of that identity. And I think, I don't know. I mean, every person's different, but I would think just based off, you know, other things that you'd want to keep that identity. So I think that's maybe like the deaf blind thing where there's a pride with that identity. And it's, yeah, I'm different, but what's wrong with being different? One person's weird is another person's normal.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the savant piano player, it actually goes past that. Not only could they play Mozart perfectly, but they could play Mozart in the style of Stevie Wonder perfectly.
That's insane.
And so it's like they could play if Stevie Wonder was playing Mozart, they could play it like that.
Mm.
Or if you were to mix and match any two musicians, they could play vice versa music. They could play this person's music in this style or this person's music like in this key. It's absolutely outrageous. If you see it, this the Savant piano players, it's crazy. Yeah, absolutely crazy.
Well, that's the same. So it kind of goes back to that theme of like, sure, you can cure that. So maybe you make up the magic pill that cures autism or cures blindness or whatever, but then you're detracting from the human race. You're detracting all these amazing things that would otherwise be happening. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they come out of suffering. They come out of loss of whatever or hardship, but that's part of what makes us human. Mm-hmm. And when you take that out, what, you know, everyone just kind of becomes robotic and perfect. And then you don't have these advancements or innovations or amazing things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that tricky thing where it's like, yeah, it sucks. And it's hard for us to talk about it being healthy individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it exists for a reason. There's that pride. Greatness comes out of hardship.
It does. It does. All right.
All right. So weekly review.
Yeah.
This is kind of an interesting topic, but we both have this kind of fascination with the tiny home thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think either one of us want to live in a 300 square foot tiny home. But like we talk about always, the characteristics and the principles used in design are pretty brilliant, right? Because you have to design all these things in a very limited space. So you really have to pick and choose the way you use your storage, your space, everything very wisely. And a cool kind of thing that I like about the tiny homes is building in the furniture, right? So when you have a 5-foot space, kind of hard to find a 5-foot couch. So a lot of times they'll build in a couch, like literally right into the wall. And then you just upholster the cushions and everything. And it's just like a normal couch, but it's actually built into the space. And then you might have like storage sliders underneath or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is the furniture stays with the house, right? So you don't have to worry about all this switching out furniture, and it fits the space perfectly. So what if people started doing that into normal size houses? So you have a 1500 square foot house, whatever. You want a sectional sofa to X dimensions. Instead of trying to find that one that fits with your space on Amazon, straight up build it right into your wall. Mm-hmm. And then you have the sectional that comes with the house. Or I guess a good example would be when people build like the breakfast nooks into the space, kind of doing that with furniture. And then it creates less waste because you're not like disposing of furniture all the time. Like, yeah, maybe you reupholster stuff every once in a while or something like that. But it makes moving easier. So if people come and view your house, they have an easier time at realizing how they could live into the space because the furniture is going to stay there, right? So they're like, oh, all right, let me try out this breakfast nook or this couch that's built in. I kind of like the way that's situated, or I don't like the way that's situated.
Mm-hmm.
So you're limiting the design in certain respects, and you're going to have to target a more niche market who wants those things. But a lot of times when they design something for the space, it turns out a lot better than if you tried to buy furniture and put it in there. So there's that catch-22 there where it might actually be better.
I think certain people would really like that. And I think certain other people would immediately rip out all of the furniture.
That's true.
And then just design their own. And also, I've noticed that it seems like on a yearly basis, maybe a little bit less often than that, everything in my house seems to get rearranged just for a change.
Feng shui.
Yeah, well, just for a change of pace, right? Because if everything's always in the same spot and everything always looks the same, then you just kind of get very used to it. And and it's no longer an accent. It's just kind of, well, I mean, in that case, it literally is part of the wall. Like, oh yeah, this is just my couch and it's always here. Mm-hmm. And then if you change it, change where it is, change where everything is, you notice it more. Does that make sense?
And yeah.
And you can kind of appreciate it more. Like, oh, wow, all right, yeah, my couch is now over in this area as opposed to over this way.
Kind of fun sometimes.
Yeah, kind of like inspirational quotes or pictures or something like that. Mm-hmm. If it's always in the same spot, you just completely stop noticing it. But then if you shift where it is, oh, wait, yeah, I remember I used to really like this. there's a picture I've got floating around of Steve Prefontaine, and it's just got a quote on it that says, "If you give or to give anything less than your best is to sacrifice the gift." And I always change where it is in the house. It's always somewhere else. And so I always try to make a habit of noticing it. Well, actually, I make a habit of moving it, and then because I move it so frequently, I notice it.
Great guy, too.
Great guy.
Too young. Far too young. We lost him.
Yeah.
But I feel, well, it would definitely depend on where you are, too, right? Mm-hmm. So if you live in a city where there's moving trucks everywhere and it's super easy to move, and you have the resources, or I think the best example is like island life. So if you watch like the HGTV International House Hunters, those kind of shows.
What do you do in your spare time, dude?
I watch a lot of HGTV, I'm not going to lie.
I miss the old HGTV.
Yeah.
Because it used to be DIY. Here's how you do this, that, and the other.
The Bob Vila days.
Yeah. And now it's just, here, we're going to go buy it. And then they show people knocking down a wall with a sledgehammer, and then it's done. You're like, wait, no, I want to know how to do it, though.
Yeah, because now you have, like, the DIY network that does that kind of stuff.
There's a whole channel.
There is a whole network.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, whole
how
channel.
Long until that's reality TV, too?
I don't know. That'd be pretty sweet, though. But I know what you're saying, though. It's changed from the original.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like how ESPN used to be, like minutes longer of highlights and then very few analysis, and now you like almost never see a highlight on ESPN and it's just like hours of people talking about the same stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the old Sports Center loop.
Yeah. Or like MTV used to be all music videos. Yeah. Now it's all reality.
And then TV. There was MTV2 that was all music videos. And then now that's also
but back to the island life.
Yeah.
So when a lot of people go and they want to buy a house on Barbados or whatever island, they usually get a little annoyed because it's like, this is the furniture the house comes with, because it's island life, right? There's not a whole lot of shipping to the islands. There's not a huge amount of resources and production going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, look, you get what you get. But if you built the furniture into that space, I don't know, maybe people would appreciate it more or like it more because it's more custom or it kind of fits better and it might not be your style, but because it's so easily utilized, then they wouldn't mind.
Yeah, kind of like if you had a patio where instead of having chairs on the patio, it was just, because on the island, everything seems to be poured concrete.
Yeah.
It's outside to prevent typhoons or hurricanes or tsunamis from causing just pure havoc. And so if your furniture is poured concrete, in essential, then you don't have a choice. It's like, oh yeah, this either I bust out this poured concrete bench or I just say the heck with it and I use it.
Yeah. It's kind of like a kitchen island, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you might buy a home with a kitchen island and it's like, yeah, it's not where you would put it and it might not be the style of your island where you're really going to rip out the island that's like built into the space, kind of very like utilitarian, like a perfect way to utilize it. Or you're just going to live with it and be like, it's not my style, but it works so well that I don't really want to rip it out. And I mean, I don't know. Some people might still rip it out, but seems like it might contribute to waste a little bit more. And then, of course, different people's styles and the way they utilize different things will be different than, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tit for tat.
Who knows?
But you talked about like the tiny house library.
Oh, yeah. I'm super looking forward to that because obviously, tiny homes, right? They'd be awesome, hypothetically. And I think something that's coming about is a tiny home office, right?
Yeah.
Where you essentially have an office in your backyard. So that way, who was it? I think it was Austin Kleon, that he works from home, but he works in his detached garage. And he said he always wants at least two doors between himself and his family and his workspace, right? And so if he's working at least two doors away, then somebody has to very deliberately enter his workspace. And so that way he can get things done and he can focus on what he's trying to do. And it's essentially like his office. And so that's where I think things like the tiny home office, you would be able to have an office that's only 300 square feet, but it's that two-door boundary between where you live and where you work.
Yeah.
And so you'd be able to go in there and you'd be able to open it up and immediately your mind and everything else would be very conducive to doing work. But on another note completely, my goal is to one day have just one of those tiny homes, except for it's a library, which I guess you could probably do an office / library. But anyway, where it's a library.
Maybe like a tiny room library.
Yeah, who knows? But the whole thing is just filled with bookshelves and books and all of that just wonderfulness, because my goal, or not goal, but my dream would be to have kind of a Beauty and the Beast style library where I've read all the books. But I feel like those are tens of thousands of books, and I would have to pretty much shift my life to just reading in order to have something like that. But like a tiny home library, I could definitely fill it up and definitely have some ornate woodwork and some nice looking bookshelves in a tiny home and fill it up with books that I've read. And I could probably do that before I was even 40.
Yeah.
Just because it wouldn't take a crazy amount of space and a crazy amount of time to read all of those books. And I could be very selective and specific.
Do you have like a 6x8 foot wall with a ladder? And it's just that little, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that. There's so many concepts. Like the storage one's a big one. The way they build storage into a tiny house is so smart. And to take those concepts and put it in a normal house, so that you're building storage very discreetly into your things. And then you have things where you need them versus everything stored in an attic or a closet where you kind of have to like go and trough through all this other shit to get the one thing you want. I think it's a great principle to use. And it gets you away from just that mass clutter, where everything kind of has a place, and it has a place for a reason.
Yeah, like if you had a reading chair, but below the reading chair was a drawer, and in that drawer you kept all the books and like a pen and some paper, and so you could just immediately, you sit in the chair, and then you pull out the book and your note paper, and you go to work.
Yeah.
And you can just go to reading. I see what you're saying, yeah. It'd be very helpful.
Yeah.
Another thing that I've seen a lot in the tiny homes is the spices being stored directly above the stove.
Yeah.
They're like magnetically attached right above there. Oh man, that would be awesome. If you just, need some garlic. There it is. Boop, 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 done. And then you just kind of slap it back up magnetically and then move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think the kitchen is where a lot of those translate into bigger homes, where that people will, because in a tiny home, you don't have the storage. So everything has to be neat and nice and kept and has its little space.
Mm-hmm.
So you see things like the spices are a good one. Or when people have, instead of like just cabinets full of, like a pantry full of flour and bacon ingredients and stuff like that, they have these nice little glass jars that sit on this one shelf and everything's labeled and it has its little space. So yeah, it forces you to be neat. Versus if you have this gigantic space, yeah, you can just throw all that shit in there. But the design looks fantastic. People look at that spice rack and they're like, oh man, I want that in my home.
Yeah, but the one thing I've always wanted is the knife magnet bar.
Oh, that's sweet.
Oh, I've wanted one of those for so long. They look horribly dangerous, but just so awesome. I don't know. I have a strange fascination with kitchen knives. I just, I filled out my knife block. That was pretty much one of the first things I did as an adult was buy a nice, I think it's J.A. Heckel's knife block. And then it was only about half full and then slowly filled it up with bread knives and fillet knives and all those other things. But, oh man, I love it. I think it was probably the scene in one of the Kill Bill movies where there was this sushi chef making something and he kept pulling knives off the magnetic knife block, and he was in this argument with I think his brother, and then he would just kind of throw the knife back at the wall and it would just stick back at the magnetic on the magnetic bar, and then he grabbed the next one.
Great scene.
Yeah, I loved it. And I've always wanted to do that.
That's what created the fascination.
Yeah, that's probably what started it.
Stairs are another good one. Stairs, like
in
the average home, right, you just have stairs and it's a wall. But then in a tiny home, you got stairs and like the individual stair might pop open, or you have a little slide out from there, and then like on the other side of the staircase you have this wall where it's little cubbies or little slide outs. And I think that's a super cool thing that is unique, and it creates that organization in a bigger home too.
Do you think there are any people out there who have an elaborate understairs storage unit and perhaps too much of a fascination with Harry Potter that decided to raise one of their children under the stairs in the hopes that perhaps you get invited to a mysterious wizarding academy?
A strange story, but I used to actually sleep in my closet when I was growing up.
Okay.
And it wasn't like a huge closet either. This was like like a 2 foot wide by like, it was a snug closet for even my like 7-year-old, 8-year-old self. But I don't know why. I just liked it. It felt cozy. It was like a little, it was almost like a fort, and I would build it like a fort. So it's like, if I was a kid and someone put me under the stairs, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think I'd be punishment. I'd be like, all right, cool. I got my little space. Let's see how I can like make it as awesome as possible. But
yeah,
I don't. Yeah, I guess it depends on. But yeah, I could definitely see a parent trying to. That's a creepy mold to try and fit your kid with.
Yeah,
maybe go with the normal molds, like trying to make your kid a soccer player or something.
Yeah,
not the.
It might be a bit of a stretch.
Semi possible abuse, depending on the child.
Yeah.
On that note.
On that note, it has been another unique and completely off the rails episode of Breakfast at Timothy's.
And yeah, do you have anything you want us to talk about? Again, just drop us a line, email us. Love to hear from our audience.
Yeah.